I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. Welcome to a bonus episode of Real Talk MS from ACTRIMS 2020. As a reminder, ACTRIMS is an acronym that stands for the America's Committee for Treatment and Research in Multiple Sclerosis. And this year, the ACTRIMS Forum has brought together about 1,200 MS research scientists and clinicians in West Palm Beach, Florida. The theme of this year's conference is Networks in MS, and the word networks can have a few different meanings when you're talking about multiple sclerosis. We know that MS isn't a single-cell disease, so some presentations at ACTRIMS will be referring to cellular and molecular networks. It's also becoming apparent that when you're talking about inflammatory activity, we are what we eat. In other words, there's a real connection between the gut microbiome and our central nervous system, and we've seen conference presentations that focus on that particular network. And we can't overlook social networks. There was a really interesting presentation by a neurologist from Harvard, whose research demonstrates that a patient's disease course can be impacted by the people they regularly connect with. So that word, or this year's theme of networks in multiple sclerosis, has been defined and refined in all the different ways that MS is impacted by networks. Now, a significant part of the ACTRIMS Forum is the opportunity that's provided to young investigators, graduate students, and postdoctoral fellows to showcase their research. This year, I've seen that research focused on the gut microbiome, imaging, progressive MS, and I've also seen emerging technologies being applied to MS research and a greater emphasis on collaborative, interdisciplinary teams on both the clinical and the research sides of MS. Another trend that's becoming more and more apparent is the role that people living with MS can play not only by participating in clinical trials, but in helping to design the studies themselves. And there are some very forward-thinking research scientists who are also starting to realize the value that care partners can add to study design, drug development, and other areas of research interest. ACTRIMS 2020 opened with a keynote address by Dr. Peter Calabrese, a professor of neurology and the director of neuroimmunology at Johns Hopkins University. And Dr. Calabrese asked the question, why is MS so variable? How do we predict which patients may need a wheelchair in 5 or 10 years, and which ones will present with a more benign form of the disease? Dr. Calabrese suggested that environmental factors like the presence of toxins, dietary factors, and other illnesses that the patient may have might all play a role. But he also suggested that there's a specific genetic component at work as well. Dr. Calabrese's research team has identified links between severe MS and two specific genes that regulate proteins in the immune system. This is very early stage work, but this discovery may very well lead to new pathways for treating MS. Among the research that's been presented at ACTRIMS, Dr. Bibi Belikova, the chief of the neuroimmunology section at the National Institutes of Health, talked about having to move beyond no evidence of disease activity, which is often referred to by the acronym NEDA, N-E-D-A, in assessing the effectiveness of a particular MS treatment. Dr. Belikova made the point that while a follow-up MRI may show no new lesion activity, there could very well be what she called non-lesional activity going on. Dr. Belikova explained that current disease-modifying therapies are very good at slowing or stopping lesional activity, but she pointed out the likelihood that disease progression could still be occurring. Dr. Belikova argued that MS treatments can be fine-tuned based upon how a specific patient is responding to a specific treatment, but only once we have a way to objectively measure both lesional and non-lesional MS progression. And she suggested that analyzing cerebrospinal fluid biomarkers using machine learning, which is a form of artificial intelligence, will accurately predict future rates of MS disability progression. Dr. Belikova's lab is currently involved in a National Institutes of Health clinical trial to determine how different MS disease-modifying therapies affect these cerebrospinal fluid biomarkers and whether those changes can predict how an individual will respond to a specific MS drug. This kind of information will allow neurologists in the clinic to tailor a treatment plan based upon an individual patient's own biology. And that customized approach to treating each patient is called precision medicine. And that's going to be a term that you'll be hearing about more and more frequently as new technologies provide physicians with the ability to gain detailed insight into any one particular patient's disease course. Some very interesting research was presented by Dr. Amar Dand, an associate professor of neurology at Brigham and Women's Hospital at Harvard. Now, Dr. Dand's research focuses on how human networks affect health outcomes, and he made the case that social isolation is a silent epidemic that isn't assessed when a patient comes to the clinic, yet has a serious impact on their overall behavioral and biological health. Dr. Dand explained that using MRI, researchers have been able to see how social isolation has produced structural changes in the central nervous systems of both animals and humans. And behaviorally, isolation can lead to smoking, as well as inactivity, sedentary behaviors, and poor sleep. And each of these outcomes has already been shown to make MS symptoms worse. Dr. Dand's early work on the effects of social isolation was focused on stroke patients, but he's now looking at people living with MS, and he's seeing that higher degrees of social support from family members and close friends and coworkers can be beneficial in adapting to progressive MS and stress related to living with MS. And this higher level of social support can also lead to the patient adopting positive behaviors like choosing a healthy diet and exercise. One of the subjects that I know is of interest to people living with MS is remyelination, or replacing the myelin coating around nerve cells. That coating is what MS destroys, and that's what creates disability. And Dr. John Mariani, a research scientist at the Center for Translational Neuromedicine at the University of Rochester, showed that implanting a specific type of stem cell called human glial progenitor cells into the demyelinated brains of mice led to complete remyelination. Now, I've said this before, but it bears repeating when we're talking about this kind of research. While the outcome is very encouraging, there are huge differences between a mouse brain and a human brain. So this research isn't yet ready for human subjects, but it certainly points to the potential benefit of using transplanted glial progenitor cells in people living with progressive MS. And when it comes to stopping MS progression, a lot of the research has been focused on cells in the peripheral nervous system, like T cells and B cells. Most disease-modifying therapy that's available today is designed to somehow mitigate, moderate, or regulate these T cells or B cells. But Dr. Francisco Quintana has instead focused on cells in the central nervous system, specifically microglia and astrocytes. And his research has yielded some real breakthroughs in understanding the inflammatory response that attacks nerve cells in MS. In fact, Dr. Quintana's research has actually been able to tie together activity generated by environmental sources, the gut microbiome, and the central nervous system. Dr. Quintana is this year's recipient of the Barancic Prize, which recognizes exceptional innovation and originality in MS research. I had the opportunity at ACTRIMS to sit down and talk with Dr. Quintana. In a moment, we'll hear my conversation with Barancic Prize recipient Dr. Francisco Quintana. I'm here at the ACTRIMS Forum talking with this year's Baranczyk Prize recipient, Professor Francisco Quintana. Professor Quintana is a professor of neurology at the Ann Romney Center for Neurologic Diseases, an associate member at the Broad Institute of Harvard and MIT, and he's the incoming president of the International Society of Neuroimmunology. In addition to pursuing his own innovative research, Professor Quintana has trained more than 30 young research scientists and participates in several programs focused on training scientists from underrepresented minorities. It's been my pleasure to know Professor Quintana for the past few years, as he's the principal investigator of a multi-year international research project that's been funded by the International Progressive MS Alliance. Now, in about an hour, you're going to take the stage here at ACTRIMS and deliver this year's Baranczyk Prize lecture. Just to remind our listeners, the Baranczyk Prize recognizes exceptional innovation and originality in MS research, with an emphasis on the potential of that research to lead to pathways for treatments and cure for MS. And your research has really blazed a new trail in understanding the inflammatory response that causes damage to the central nervous system in MS. And by the way, you've also managed to create a new way of investigating environmental factors in MS and other diseases. So I'm not going to ask you to give your entire Baranczyk Prize lecture in advance, but can you tell us about your research?
Thank you, John. So what we've been mostly focused, or one of the areas of research that is very important to us, is trying to understand what happens with cells that sit within the CNS, right? Cells like astrocytes or microglia, which for years were not the focus of research in MS. And now we know they're important because they seem to drive inflammation, drive neurodegeneration in a chronic low-grade phase, but in a stage, but in such a manner that it accumulates, and we believe it might even take the leading role in the progressive forms of MS. So my work has focused lately, or one of the areas of research we've been focused, is on trying to understand what controls astrocytes and microglia, and when I mean what controls is how is it that the microenvironment, how is it that the gut flora, how is it that the environmental pollutants, how is it that metabolism can affect the activity of those cells that sits in the CNS, and also asking those questions with a very clear goal in mind of trying to identify potential targets of therapeutic intervention.
I think one of the things my listeners might be interested in knowing is, how is it that you found yourself working in multiple sclerosis research? What is it about MS that attracted your scientific mind?
So it's putting two very important things together. On the one hand, as a child, I grew up very close to my grandfather, the father of my mom, and he was kind of like my superhero, right? He was this big guy. I mean, physically very big. He was like 2 meters, you know, 2 square meters, 2 times 2. Very strong, very active, and I would spend my summer since I was like 5 years old. I would spend 3-4 months with him. Eventually, he came down with neurologic disease, and for years, I mean, he was still with us, but he was seriously incapacitated, mentally and physically. So that focused me on neurologic diseases. And then the other thing that's very important for me as a biologist, I got very interested in inflammation in the immune system and how it can control health and disease. So when it came to decide what I wanted to do in my life as a scientist, it was very clear that I wanted to put these two things together. And MS being, you know, studying inflammation in the brain was the very clear option. And as I said before, with this goal in mind, not only of trying to understand how things work or don't work, but hopefully trying to identify targets, ways, mechanisms that we can exploit therapeutically.
You know, as I mentioned a moment ago, in addition to pursuing your own research, you've also focused on training young investigators and scientists from underrepresented minorities. What's important about that to you?
Well, I think there are many things. I mean, as I myself, as you can hear, you know, I have an accent. I hasn't been able, and I never wanted to hide it, right? And first of all, there are some misconceptions that are important on both sides, right? On the one hand, I think there are ways of thinking, there are there are habits that have to be created, have to be strengthened, right, from people coming from disadvantaged minorities in order to really succeed in science. And succeed in science here or in Europe, you know, where real action happens. And also, it's for us to demonstrate that we have it in us and we can perform as well as anyone else, right? Having said that, I don't think anyone should get anything for free, right? And it is my role just to mentor and, or I chose as a role, try to mentor and help these students to develop. And there's something very rewarding to see your former students to succeed and have their own lives and their own careers. And this, I really love that.
Well, Professor Quintana, I want to thank you for the breakthrough work that you're doing to solve the riddle of multiple sclerosis and for the special effort you continue to make to train tomorrow's scientists. And thanks for taking the time from what I know is a very demanding schedule to talk with me today.
Thank you, John. See you later.
During the ACTRIMS Forum, I also came across new technology from Cortex Labs that leverages artificial intelligence to analyze MRI images much faster and in a much more detailed and accurate manner. I met with Mickey Mace, the clinical specialist at Cortex Labs, and she explained why this technology can be so useful to neurologists in the clinic. In a moment, we'll hear my conversation with Mickey Mace. I am at the ACTRIMS Forum, and I'm speaking with Marilyn Mays, the clinical specialist for Cortex Labs. Now, Cortex Labs takes machine learning, artificial intelligence, and uses very sophisticated algorithms to be able to see things in an MRI scan that are sometimes not always apparent. And that way, a neurologist is getting a more complete indication of things like brain volume and mass, and not to mention lesion identification, the kinds of things that make the neurologist's job of helping someone living with MS easier, and more important than easier, much more accurate. So one of Cortex's primary applications is called LesionQuant, and it is specifically designed to help clinicians identify and diagnose multiple sclerosis. And clinical specialist Mickey Mays is going to kind of walk us through how that process would work.
John, thanks for having me. I'm passionate about MS and really looking for a rubric to break and solve the questions that we have around it. Our product is a leading edge in AI and helping us do that. We do that by taking a sagittal 3D T1 MR scan joined with a T2 flare scan and looking at T1 white matter hypointensities and T2 hyperintensities. We then take those and we get volumes of lesions. We look at those lesions following McDonald criteria. So we're looking at them regionally and we're looking to disseminate them in time and space. So we can track these longitudinally. We can then give the clinician real empirical evidence as to where the lesions are. And we calculate a lesion burden, which is the healthy white matter to lesion ratio. That allows them to really see what is happening in the brain. And again, we look at this longitudinally so we can see the effects of drug therapies and various MS treatments to see if they're efficacious and whether or not the patient is responding. Really also shortens the clinical cycle and improves the overall clinician's efficacy.
Well, talking about shortening the cycle, it really does save a tremendous amount of time compared to the way things are more traditionally done or have been done. So give us a peek into how things are going to be done when imaging centers and MRI centers are incorporating your technology. What's the time saving there?
Wow, that's a really great question. To do this manually takes hours sometimes. Physicians, neurologists, and neuroradiologists are looking at hundreds of images for one patient, and they're looking in numerous different planes, and they're looking at tiny, dim lesions that maybe are resolving. Maybe it's a new exacerbation, and they're trying to resolve where it is. Is it touching the periventricular area? Is this going to take out the patient's bladder? How big is it? What's the trajectory? They're able to see this in minutes, literally under 20 minutes, where it could take hours for a clinician to try to resolve this. This is the beauty of AI. This is the future.
So not only are you saving time, but you're also improving accuracy.
Absolutely. So that's one of the big things. The two things I always say, saves time and improves objectivity. We're giving empirical evidence. This is a raw volume of what this lesion size is and how it's impacting that healthy white matter.
So while we're talking, I know that you are also part of a team of experts that has put forward a recommendation to update the recommendations for standardized MRI protocol for MS. Can you talk to us a little bit about what that is and why it's important?
Yeah, John, that's a really, you're asking me some great questions. We're really looking to try to standardize the MR scans so that MS patients don't have to go through the rigors of hours in a scanner and getting gadolinium every single time. New research has found MS patients don't need GAD, and that gadolinium sits in their brain, and we don't know what that might do to them long term. They don't need that. We can quantify without GAD, and we do it flawlessly. So this is another huge benefit.
And this expert panel was put together by CMSC, is that correct? So it's a consortium of MS centers. It incorporates experts from across the country, from the National MS Society. You were a participant. How long did it take to put this recommendation together?
Well, it's been a couple of years in the making, actually. We spent 3 days kind of sequestered, and it was really an exciting thing to work on. We worked over specific protocols, what protocols work, what protocols don't, what's the standardized care so that patients can have consistent care and consistent follow-up. And then the really big coup, I think, that the takeaway this year was not having to give GAD every year. It's really not necessary. That was the biggest win for the patient.
It also sounds like it's a win when that patient knows from year to year, if they're going for that annual MRI, it's going to be standardized, so it'll be easier to compare disease activity, progression, if there is any, et cetera.
Exactly. You've nailed that.
Mickey Mays, I appreciate your time. Thanks for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
That's going to wrap up this special ACTRIMS 2020 episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And if you have a friend or family member who might also enjoy listening to the podcast, you can share this episode with them by suggesting they point their web browser to realtalkms.com/ACTRIMS2020. That's realtalkms.com/ACTRIMS2020. And you'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into your email or text. And I hope you'll take just a minute to visit realtalkms.com/walkms and make a donation toward Walk MS today. The MS Society is the largest private funder of MS research in the world, and I think supporting their efforts just makes a lot of sense. This year, I'm walking to honor the memory of my wife, Jean, so I'm inviting you to help. Just visit realtalkms.com/walkms, and you'll also find that link in today's show notes. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.